we return, it is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with nature writer Lyanda Lynn Haupt. The topic is bestiaries, or bestiaries. Merriam-Webster says bestiaries. The term dates back to the Middle Ages. They were books of lists with natural history descriptions of animals, birds, rocks, trees, and such. And Lyanda Lynn Haupt has written The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild, and she joins us via Skype from Seattle. Welcome to Lyanda.
Lyanda?
Hello there. We're having a little bit of a difficulty.
No,
here.
We had her before.
Yeah, we did. Our staff is working on this. Meanwhile, Bonnie, you're a big animal lover. I remember being with you one time and we saw a fox and you wanted to name it and feed it.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have quite a bit of that kind of action in South Florida.
We do. We didn't... There. Lyanda?
Do you want me to hang up and have you try calling again?
No, or? There you are.
You sound fine now.
Oh, you've got me now?
Yes.
Yeah, we've got you now.
Okay, I don't know what happened there.
Oh, we don't know. Did you hear us?
I heard you just fine, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Good to have you with us.
Bestiaries.
Okay, here we all are. Okay.
Bestiaries or bestiaries?
You know, you're right, Joseph. Both are correct. And I prefer a bestiary. You're free to say bestiary through the interview if you like. I say bestiary just because it contains the word, you know, it sounds more beastly and suits my subject matter.
Well, see, I was a little bit afraid of that because it's also close to bestiality.
Oh, dear. I have a story to tell you about that,
oh,
of course.
Oh, we want to hear that.
Don't worry, it's suitable for radio. When I told my mother some time ago when I started working on this book what the working title was, there was silence on the other end of the phone. And she said, is that like bestiality? I assured my sweet mother that it was not. But no, I understand why you might choose the alternate pronunciation for that reason.
Well, we'll do both probably.
Okay.
So Lyanda, I was so struck, you write with such heart and compassion about our fellow creatures here. When did you develop your deep love and curiosity for these non-humans?
You know, that actually started in childhood. And I think that the things that we are drawn to are in part innate and in part nurtured by our environment. I mean, there's that old nature versus nurture debate. But whenever you ask any of us, you know, how did we come to love what we love? It's difficult to come up with, you know, the very beginning. But when I was young, I lived in a normal suburban neighborhood, and there was a canyon behind, there was a vacant lot behind our house and a canyon behind that. Of course, that's all covered with houses now. But when I was young, that was all kind of open space. And I loved that feeling of freedom that I could get climbing down into the canyon and just being there with, there were frogs and fish in the stream at the bottom.
I loved sort of seeing how, or learning how,
very calmly, the animals that had run away, you know, whether they were birds or frogs or fish, when I had bumbled into their place, how if I sat very still, they would over time come back and return and go back to their normal lives very close to me. And so I developed that sort of ardent love of that being in a more than human world and having it go on about me in my presence since I was very young, and then continued on in more formal studies of that subject throughout my life.
Of course, if you're a gardener, some of these critters you would call pests.
That's absolutely true. And I'm a gardener, and it's one of those great paradoxes, I think, that people garden because we feel that it brings us closer to nature. But if you're a gardener, you know that. Are you both gardeners in your life there?
I am somewhat.
I'm not really a gardener,
Bonnie's
no.
An apartment dweller.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're a gardener, and I know a lot of your listeners are, you find out that starting a garden that's supposedly bringing you closer to nature is one of the quickest ways to come into conflict with the natural world, because all of a sudden, everything from insects to rats and raccoons and on up is coming to nibble away at the food or the flowers that you're growing for your own enjoyment. You know, I really like to reframe the idea of conflict. I think that I think of it instead as participation with the natural world. When we're starting to grow food or flowers or change the landscape or create human homes in areas that were once wilder edges, what we're doing is we're coming into nature's story, and we need to figure out how to coexist with the wild animals that are able. There are not that many species that are able to flourish in urban areas. And so the ones that are able to, I think we have to figure out ways that we can both flourish and coexist in safety and in wisdom. And the more that we know about the natural the wild creatures that live among us, the better we can find the way to coexistence. So instead of conflict, I like to think of creative participation.
So why do you think most of us suffer from this major disconnect? Do you think it's fear? Do you think it's confusion? Is it misinformation? Are these the things you want to address with your book?
Yeah, it's all those things. You know, Bonnie, one of the things that's happened very recently in human history, and this is really in the last decade, we can't find the exact date on the calendar, but it's somewhere in the last 5 to 10 years. For the first time on the history of Earth, more humans are living in urban areas than in rural areas. And so it's very recent. And yet we've come and we've built these beautiful straight roads and dwelling places.
Human culture and human life. And we've left behind the practical knowledge that we've had
very recently had of how to live on the land and how to live alongside other creatures, not expecting that we'd need it here. And yet, as our habitat continues, or our own human creations and neighborhoods continue to encroach on what was very recently, you know, wild lands, we see that our human dwellings are semi-permeable, these, you know, great fortresses of human residence that we've built up are now hosting not just pigeons and robins and starlings, but also raccoons and coyotes and alligators where you live, which is astonishing for me to think of. And so we're not really quite sure how to respond. There's so much information on social media, but of course that's unvetted and people say whatever they want. Emotions run really high. And then in the supposedly more vetted mainstream media, you find oftentimes that the mainstream media is going for the story. So they're going for the hype, they're going for the blood. And so fears and harms are hyped, and good common sense and scientific information is missing. So I think there's a whole conglomerate of reasons that we're not quite, that we're confused.
Is there an element of urban legend in some of these?
Oh, there absolutely is. I went to a reading recently where someone told me that they had heard that adult coyotes, and I know you don't have coyotes in southern Florida, but up, you know, further north, I know there are some, but this would apply to foxes as well, I think. The myth goes that adult coyotes were teaching the young coyotes to lure domestic puppies into the woods where they would be eaten by the family.
Mm.
So, I mean, there are all kinds of stories like this running around. One myth I read on the internet was that, and I read this in so many different places, was that the reason that raccoons can get in our houses so well, especially through our cat doors, is that they have no shoulders. So this is that, you know, we're all vertebrate mammals and we all have shoulders. Raccoons have narrow shoulders, but that's just the kind of thing that's out there in so many places.
I was watching a documentary recently about raccoons and how quickly they adapt to urban areas. They can get into trash cans that are really locked very well. They can maneuver through traffic.
And well, their hands are so
adept.
Yes.
Agile.
That's right. And Bonnie, it's wonderful that you call them hands, because even though officially, right, they're paws.
Oh, that's right. But they look like hands.
They look so much like hands. They look like human hands, I think, more than just about any other animal. And their first toe is not quite an opposable thumb, but it is so, they make such good use of it. They can actually figure out how to undo locks. They can untie knots. I learned recently that they can tie knots. So it's no wonder that we kind of misascribe nefarious intent to some of their actions, I think, because we look at their paws and we think, well, they're so much like hands. And so they're kind of thinking up the same kinds of things to do that, that humans do. Or we look at those masks and they're...
Right. Yeah.
And of course, they're very cute, but also they're not something to be messed with, especially if they're cornered somewhere.
That's exactly right.
And they can be rabid as well.
Here in the Pacific Northwest where I live, we're fortunate that there is no rabies among terrestrial mammals. But in much of the country, it's a concern. However, if you use common sense when you encounter wild animals, then you should never be, there's no reason for anyone to be bitten by a raccoon. And you brought up one of the most important aspects of this, and that is if they feel cornered, and especially during the breeding season when they have young, that are vulnerable, that's when a raccoon, is more aggressive. And anytime that we're in a space where there's a raccoon, whether it's outdoors or indoors or in a possum or any other wild animal, one of the most important things to remember is to allow it space to leave. And if it feels that it can leave, then the level of aggression is minimized.
We're speaking with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. She's a naturalist, an urban naturalist, an award-winning author. And her latest book is The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents, and we'll return.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Lyanda Lynn Haupt. We're talking about her book, The Urban Bestiary. Perhaps our listeners would like to chime in. That's easy enough. Perhaps you have a South Florida critter story to relate. You can give us a call at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also, if you're a little shy, we have email radio@WLRN.org.
Or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. Lyanda, I want to get on to some other creatures, but how did you find out that raccoons could tie knots?
Hello?
Lyanda?
Having a little difficulty again. We're using our Skype.
Can you hear me now?
There yes. We are.
Okay, I don't know what the story is. Okay, you've got me there.
We got you.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
No.
I can hear you the whole time.
It's kind of an adventure. We like it.
Just never
<It's>
know.
Wild.
Wild.
Unpredictable, like right. The urban wild.
Yeah, so how did you find out that they could tie knots? That's interesting.
Oh, I read that in some research by Washington State Fish and Wildlife. And so I called up the author of the study, and he said, in fact, it was just through anecdotal observation that they were observed both untying knots and then returning the knots as they had found them tying.
Why would they tie a knot?
Yeah, exactly.
Unless they're docking a boat or something.
Well, that's frightening to think about. Who knows what they've got in mind. But it seemed to be no reason that there was not a specific reason that they were tying knots. As far as I could tell in this research, it seemed to be a form of play for them.
Well, I'd like to turn to one that's generally despised and feared, but you speak so passionately about the rat, and especially the female rat. So could you tell us about the rat and all the wonders of rats?
Well, I have to tell you, Bonnie, I'm not a rat apologist and I'm not a rat lover. And just about like anyone else, if I see a rat too close, I was so embarrassed the other day because I saw a rat in our neighborhood and I screamed. I thought, oh no, I hope no one saw that here. I'm peddling this book and screaming at this innocent kind of small and not scary or dangerous member of the urban wild. One of the interesting things about rats, and I think we know this if we've met any pet rats, is that they are incredibly intelligent. They respond to their names. They're playful. They can do tricks as well as any dog, but they like to hang out in our pockets and, just be with us. And the wild rats share the same amiability, the same sociability, the same capacity for connection, of course, as the pet rats do, even more so because they have that wild intelligence. Some of the new research that has fascinated me is that rats are very altruistic with other members of their species. And there was this wonderful research out of the University of Chicago that demonstrated this by putting a rat in a tiny plexiglass cage with a locked door inside of a larger plexiglass cage. And in the larger cage, there was another rat. And that rat would almost always busily try to work on the lock and figure out how to free the rat in the smaller cage. And it was not rewarded for this behavior. So it was just pure, you know, altruism. When the other rat, if there's videos of this that you can see of this research. And the best part about it to me is that when the small cage rat escaped or was set free by its friend rat, the two rats would kind of celebrate. They'd squeal and run together around the big cage. When researchers upped the ante, and in the big cage they put some of the rat's favorite treat, which was milk chocolate chips, they wanted to see if the free rat would eat the chocolate chips, you know, and keep them all for herself before letting out the caged rat. And what typically happened was that although she might eat one piece of chocolate, she would always save some for the rat inside the cage. And they would, again, when the caged rat was free, they would celebrate together and then run over and eat the chocolate.
That is really something.
Isn't it so interesting? But as you mentioned, it's female rats. And I am saying she when I recount this research. And that's because if you are ever stuck in a cage, you had better hope that it's a female rat that comes to find you, because 80% of the time, the female rats would free the caged rat, and the males only did it 20% of the time.
Well, remember George Orwell in Room 101 with the rats?
I don't.
Oh, in 1984?
1984, yeah.
Oh, that's right, yes.
And also, they're clean. That's the other surprising thing.
Except they urinate all the time. They're marking all the time. If you want to keep rats out of your house, make sure they have no access to water and you won't have any problems with them.
Right. Denying access is the best way to control a rat problem. And they don't urinate more than any other animal. But if they're in numbers in a small space, then, of course, it's going to add up and be a problem.
Let's take a telephone call or two, or you want to have another question?
Well, Sergio lives in Delray Beach, West Delray Beach. One morning he saw a white fox across the street in his neighbor's yard. He noticed me immediately when he got close to the screen door. That's all he says. And then we have another emailer that said, Nicholas says he saw an otter in the lake behind his apartment, but nobody believes him. And there was an otter attack in South Florida last year. It was rabid. You don't have otters in the book.
No, I don't. And the reason is I wanted to, and I'm sorry, I don't know anything about this this local otter issue for you. I don't have otters. And one of the reasons is I wanted to have as many creatures that were as common to everyone in all of North America as I could. And so otters being more limited to people that live close to water, I didn't have any specifically water dwelling.
Let's take a telephone call. This is Claire. She's in Dania Beach. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we live pretty close to a little swamp area, and we've got our plenty share of raccoons. But one night we were celebrating and left a box of pizza out and the TV on and went to sleep. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up to get some water, walked around the corner. The raccoon came through the cat door, opened up the box of the pizza, holding the slice in his, like you said, paw, hand, had his head toward the TV watching I Love Lucy. Now,
do you think
why
he,
I don't have a camera?
Do you think he microwaved a slice, too?
He probably could have. And I shoot him out, and horrible me, I close the box up on the pizza, put it in the refrigerator, and told my husband, there's lunch for tomorrow in the refrigerator, honey.
Oh, my.
I didn't really. But, yes, they are very, very smart little animals, and we've got our share of them here in Dania Beach.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
Sure. Bye.
Bye-bye. Lyanda, tell us more about raccoons. And I guess the best thing to do, again, with raccoons is to stay away from them and not feed them, if possible.
That's right. You know, this is one of the wonderful things that I was thinking about before this conversation today, was that here I live in Seattle, and y'all live in South Florida, and we have lots of different animals. I will never see an alligator in my backyard or hear about any of my neighbors seeing one unless something has gone totally awry.
Sometimes we get them in the swimming pools.
That's what I've heard, and I just find that astonishing. And of course, we have very few snakes and reptiles here. And yet, we all have, it's not just that we all have some of the same animals like raccoons, but what's really interesting to me is that the way that we can coexist with the wildlife among us, no matter what it is, from coyotes here to alligators there, the steps are always the same. And the main one is to not inadvertently feed wildlife. So we need to, I mean, if we want to prevent conflict, if we want to allow wildlife to flourish and to keep ourselves and our homes safe, what we want to do is make sure that we bring in the cat and dog food at night, make sure that our garbage cans are secured. And if you have a lot of raccoons or other adept animals in your neighborhood, you'll have to secure them with bungee cords or other ways to keep those lids on. And then seal up any potential entrances to our homes. And those are very simple steps. They might be inconveniences, but I just think that they're minor inconveniences when we're given the choice of having, you know, just human, kind of deadened human fortresses where only we can live versus enlivened neighborhoods where many species can flourish safely.
Let's take another call. This is Jason and Davey. He wants to talk about coyotes in South Florida. Hey, Jason.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. We absolutely do have coyotes here in South Florida, by the way.
I've never seen one in almost 40 years of living here, but tell us.
Well, University of Florida is actually in the middle of a study right now. The city of Parkland has had several captured and killed up there in livestock situations. The town of Davie has had several captured and killed, and now they are into Southwest Ranches. Now, for your expert on the line, South Florida, where we're calling from and where I'm referring to, is just west of Fort Lauderdale. So that certainly is South Florida, and they are migrating down the trails and down 27 all the way down to South Florida, and they're moving further south day by day. And I know University of Florida is involved in that research and that study now.
Hmm.
So they are here.
Yeah, that mirrors my understanding exactly, that there are scattered sightings and more sightings as you get further south, and established populations further north. Sure. And that makes sense, given their the adaptability of the species.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So they are definitely have been here. They are currently here. The small livestock, goat farms, your sheep farms, your poultry farms are usually where they're found and where they're captured. Obviously, they're out for their prey, but they just wanted to let people know that they were, in fact, here, and if you do see them, you need to contact animal control.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for calling.
We move along to Jim in West Palm Beach. Hi.
Hi, this is Jim in West Palm Beach?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I got stories about wildlife in South Florida. You remember Bird Road and the Palmetto used to have a big drive-in theater called the Tropicare?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they do flea markets on the weekend. I was kind of down on my luck and going through like my hippie drug abuser phase. And a fellow let me move in with them over there. And it turned out that back by that drive-in, there was like a nursery because there were pots all over it. Just maybe like a little half acre of space or whatever. And there was like a family of tame foxes that lived in there. And I used to go tramping around in there. And in fact, I actually had a small pot farm for a while. And you'd come up on these foxes, and they would just sit and look at you.
Jim, don't tell us too much, please.
Yeah, the statute of limitations is already done, and it was a stupid thing to do, and I regret it and all that. But, you know, it's kind of, I don't know what happened to them, you know, because eventually they put in a Target and a Publix there and stuff like that. I hope somebody, you know, had the grace to trap them, but I kind of doubt it, to be honest with you. And before I forget, raccoons carry a thing called raccoon roundworm, and gets into human brains, and it basically eats your brain. It's in the raccoon, it's symbiotic. It infects them, but it doesn't destroy them the way it does other creatures. And the theory is that with other creatures, say like, you know, rats or something like that, that would eat, you know, come into contact with raccoon droppings and get this worm, it sort of like makes them stupid, which makes them an easy meal for the raccoon.
Are you familiar with that, Lyanda?
Yeah, absolutely. And the main issue for us to think about as co-inhabitants with raccoons in our neighborhoods is that raccoon roundworm eggs can be found in the feces of raccoons. And it's usually fine if you're out, you know, in the open air. There's really no danger of inhaling or ingesting them unless, you know, you're a child and for some reason you are actually eating the feces, which is very uncommon, we hope. But if you have raccoons that are nesting in a part of your home, in your attic or under your house, you want to be very, very careful about, you know, a space that doesn't have a lot of air, where a lot of feces are gathered in one place. And either, you know, wear a mask and be very careful in the removal after, you know, the nesting period is over and the raccoons have left, or have it professionally removed. Ideally, that would be the case. So incidences of human infection from raccoon roundworm are very, very rare, but it is possible and care should be taken.
We're speaking with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. She's a naturalist, award-winning author. She's created and directed educational programs for Seattle Audubon and worked in raptor rehab in Vermont. You've done a lot of things. Are you still a seabird researcher for the Fish and Wildlife Service in the remote tropical Pacific?
I am not, and I am a writer now, and that's my main work and form of activism is through my writing and form of research as well.
Okay. Well, we're on Topical Currents with a short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Her latest book is entitled The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. Lyanda, we have a emailer. I saw a news program about the Argentine tego lizard invading Florida and roaming in backyards. Can they cause harm? And if so, what can be done without killing them? Are you familiar with that?
I am. And the best thing, one of the things for me, again, is fascinating talking to you there in Florida, because here when we have escaped snakes or lizards, they just die. And I understand in Florida that there's a lot of problem with escaped amphibians and reptiles.
Especially pythons.
Mm-hmm. Especially pythons, and not just reptiles, but also birds, like the monk parakeet, establishing populations and having possible impact on native wildlife. As far as that particular species goes, it seems to me that I can't speak to that particular species. It's my understanding that there's not a danger from that lizard, but your Fish and Wildlife online has all kinds of information about every specific species and what you should do, how to identify it, how to tell them from the non-native from the native species, which are harmful, which aren't, and which need warrant a phone call to Fish and Wildlife. So I would always go with those local resources.
What about what many people think of as flying rats, and those would be pigeons, which seems so common, but you have a lot of information about pigeons that, well, I was unaware of.
Well, pigeons are fascinating in that most, in the cities, most of the birds that we see are some kind of songbird in the order of birds that we think of as songbirds, whereas pigeons are in the dove family, and people are often surprised. They say, oh, pigeons look like doves, but they're so different, when actually pigeons and doves are the very same thing, and we just call larger doves pigeons. But taxonomically, they're the same. Pigeons, I used to be such a speciesist and kind of dislike pigeons because, like everyone else, I thought they seemed really stupid. New studies show that they have a strong mathematical ability. They can order pairs of numbers up to about the number 10, and they could put those pairs in the proper order. And so in that, they rival small primates, the same studies being done on small primates. So that's kind of wonderful. One thing that I really do appreciate about pigeons is that they are very tameable. And when you are in close contact with a tame adult pigeon. Almost, I did rehabilitation. And so supposedly we were taking care of injured birds of prey, but people would bring in any kind of bird. And anyone who does rehab knows that this is the case. And so most rehab facilities won't take in these non-native species like pigeons, or they'll take them in and, you know, wring their necks. But I just couldn't bring myself to do that. And there's so many species, I thought, you know, this one pigeon being taken care of and re-release isn't really going to impact.
Especially if a pigeon can do your taxes.
Exactly. So what I learned was, although most species of birds can only be tamed if you get them when they're very young, that's not true with an adult pigeon. If it hangs out with you for a few days and you feed it, it will become very tame. And they'll sit kind of in the crook of your arm or climb up and cuddle next to your neck and make that soft cooing sound. There's something very calming about pigeons. And what I've discovered, although I don't work close up with pigeons these days, is that in the very deep, you know, urban centers where we're not really seeing much else besides starlings and house sparrows and pigeons, sitting down and taking a moment to observe them can confer on us sort of all of the benefits of spending calm time in a natural environment. And I think that when we just take a moment from our day and we look at an animal that it like a pigeon, it can be as common as a pigeon, and here it is living its animal life that has nothing to do with us, we're sort of removed from our own, you know, anxieties and worries and the human economy, and we're just dropped into this other economy of nature, and we're taken out of our life and understand that although our concerns are very significant and important, that they're cradled by something broader and wider. And that's very enlivening and I think healthy for all of us. So something as simple and common as a pigeon can bring those benefits of the natural world into our daily life.
Well, we'll stay with an avian topic. This is Robert in Plantation. Hi.
Hi. I have a smart bird story. Years ago, there were some green birds. I want to say they were parrots, but my friend said, you got to come see this, because there were lots of trees at this intersection. And the birds would come out of the trees, and they'd, like, drop nuts in the crosswalks. And then the cars would run it over, and then the lights would change, and they'd fly down and pick the nuts back up and go back to the trees. They were actually breaking the nuts with the car tires, and then they'd go back to the trees.
I missed what you said at the beginning. It was a little muffled. What kind of birds were you talking about?
I think they were parrots, but they were some type of green bird. They weren't like a pigeon, where they were gray or white like the little Everglades birds we see around here. They were almost like a pigeon. But I'm not sure. It was years ago. I don't remember what they were. But I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. I walked by that intersection all the time, never saw it. And this guy who's here all the time said, you got to stop and see this. And it was really cool.
Landa?
That behavior is not uncommon at all in some of the more intelligent species. It's particularly common in crows. So it has to be a big bird, big enough to be able to pick up a nut. Or here, if you live along a shoreline, sometimes they'll have snail shells and they'll do the same thing. So they will absolutely sit on a wire or tree next to the road, drop it in a place where they're expecting cars to go by, and when it gets run over, they'll retrieve the snail or the nuts. So it's very, very common in crows, and that's where the most research about this behavior has been done. I would be surprised if it were a pigeon, but not surprised if it were a parrot.
What is your fascination with crows? Your last book was Crow Planet. What is that from?
You know, I think that crows are, because they're so widespread, because they're so intelligent, unlike pigeons, they're a native bird here. So they're a native wild bird. And for me, being so common, so smart, so full of wondrous observable behavior, they're the perfect window or gateway species into the idea of observing the urban wilderness. So if we wanted to pick one species that was accessible, that was smart, that was easy to study, that would bring us into another world of animal life that, you know, a bird that we could study every single day for the rest of our life and still be scratching the surface about what there is to know. The crow is sort of the perfect species to choose. Now, they're not my favorite species. I think crows cause a lot of problems. I'm not a crow apologist, but I do think that here we live, the urban wilds are very complicated. And sometimes in terms of observation and study and inspiration, we have to take what we can get.
I've seen ravens at the Tower of London. How do those differ from a crow?
Well, they're very closely related. They're the same genus, actually. And here we have ravens in this country as well, less common, and they're much less social and common in urban places than crows are. A lot of people think that ravens are just, you know, a bigger crow, bigger and smarter crow. And it's true that although ravens can problem solve sometimes at a higher level than crows can, they can do some problems that require more steps. Or as intelligent birds, both crows and ravens play, and sometimes raven play has more rules or is more complicated. So people assume that ravens are smarter for all of these reasons. But what's really interesting to note is that crows have a very strong and complicated social network. And now we see them, you know, it's the end of the breeding season. So for a while, they've been broken off in their family groups and on their territories where they raise young. But now as autumn comes, those groups are breaking down and they're forming these great flocks. And they have a tremendous social intelligence. They have a form of their communication is more complicated than ravens because there are so many more of them to keep track of. Their number of vocalizations are more complicated. They have a system of crow justice. They have helpers at the nest sometimes, which are crows that are not breeding, but that just come to assist the breeding pair. So all of these things are evidence of a kind of intelligence that's specific to crows. Quite wonderful.
What's crow justice?
Oh, crow justice. Well, one of the things that crows dislike is a difference. So if a crow behaves differently, looks differently, they will be sometimes attacked or ostracized by other crows. But sometimes it's also a matter of behavior. If you violate the sort of social code of the crow and you, if you try to, you know, mate with a bird that is not your mate or some other crow altercation. The crows will take it into their own hands to ostracize a member of the group.
Amazing.
Most birds do not have a system of justice.
Yeah.
As crows do. So it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Lyanda Lynn Haupt, and her latest book is The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. One more short break, and we'll be back with today's topical currents. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Lyanda Lynn Haupt, author of The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. Also, we advise our listeners that we'll have links concerning the book, and also we'll put on the Florida Fish and Wildlife website link on our Facebook page as well as WLRN.org.
And Lyanda, you blog at thetangledness.com, is that right?
That's right.
TheTangledNest.com, and your website is LyandaLynnHaupt.com. And we'll have links to that, too, on the WLRN
Lyanda,
website.
In your book, you talk about possums, and you call them the urban monster. I have a wooden fence around my house in Miami Lakes here in Florida, and there's been an albino possum that walks around on that fence all the time. He's really ghastly looking. I've never seen an albino possum.
Oh, I've seen albino possums.
Yeah.
Yes, because when I used to take care of the cats, the possums would come to eat as well.
So how do we deal with possums? Just ignore them?
You know, just ignore them. I mean, one of the things about opossums, they're so funny. When they were the first English-speaking sighting of a possum was one of the commanders of the Columbus ship Nina in 1492, and he saw a possum and he sent word of it home. He said that it was a monster. So that's where I got this name. He said it had the hinder feet of a monkey and its front feet were like a man and its ears were like an owl, and under its belly hung a great bag, because of course it's a marsupial, right? The only North American marsupial. So he sent this description back, and in the images that he drew or paintings that they also sent back, it just gave the people back in Europe this glimpse into the new country as kind of a depraved, loathsome land of monstrosity. So it just fed their imagination, and the opossum became kind of the flag bearer of the horrors of the new world. But if you speak to anyone, if you hang out with opossums, or you speak to anyone who's studied them, or even wildlife professionals that remove them, you learn very quickly that they're very placid, they're very gentle, they're very quiet. All they really want is to stay away from us. And it's one of the problems is that the main time that we see them is when they're scared to death. If they see us and they're in a corner and we're there with the broom trying to get them out, you know, they think, oh, I'm gonna die, you know. So that's when they start baring their teeth and making their hissing noises and looking like the monster that the commander of the ship had described. They have lots of teeth. They have 50 teeth, which is more than any other North American mammal, and about the same as a T-Rex. So they can look kind of fearsome, but they are placid, quiet Brady cats. And if we just let them be, they will avoid us.
Yeah, they're very sweet.
They are. Possums. They are funny looking. We dislike them because we don't like how they look. And they have those kind of, even though they're not rodents, of course, they're marsupials, but they have those long kind of ratty tails that we don't like. So it's all, our dislike of them is all surface level. It's just based on, you know, their odd looks and their strange behaviors. But, you know, watching them walk around through the night, just kind of gently and slowly, you can come to an appreciation for this kind of slow-moving, peaceful animal. And they're not stupid. They've done task tests on opossums and find that they perform about as well as domestic dogs, animals that we think are, you know, as pets, we think are super smart. So
let's go to Lisa in Fort Lauderdale. Thanks for your patience, Lisa. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I just had a comment about unusual animals, rare and unusual animals. I myself have done an 8-year study on a rare animal called a jaguarundi, and it's a small wild cat, a little bit larger than a house cat, but it is in the puma family. It's in Florida, although it's mostly known to be native in Central and South America and Mexico and along the Gulf Coast, but it's found in Florida, or I found through my studies it's in Florida, and I've had over the last 8 years about probably in the range of 200 anecdotal reports come to my attention, and quite a few of them are from people that report seeing them either running across a road or eating cat food left out on their back porch, or hearing them scream in the night. They kind of have a scream that sounds like a baby in distress, and people go running out and they see something that they know is not a house cat, but they're not sure what it is. And I've talked to wildlife officials, I've talked to park rangers, and they'll all tell me that they've seen it or they know of it, but they'll always tell me that it's off the record. They'll never say it officially. So I just wanted to put it out there that, you know, a lot of people see strange and unusual things, and they go on the internet and they try to look things up and find information about it. So, you know, don't be surprised if you come across something that, you know, is not actually, you know, in the guidebooks that's supposed to be there.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome.
Wyanda, you have any comment?
Hello. Once again.
Once again.
Okay. Do you have me now?
Yes, we have you.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Yeah, it's my understanding that the jaguarundi population is a feral population from escaped pets in Florida. And, you know, it used to be easier to get exotic pets than it is now. And I think that probably these limited populations are from pets from decades ago. But occasionally there is still an illicit exotic pet trade, and people can still get animals that turn out to be wilder than they expect, and they're released. So it's my understanding that these aren't, you know, animals that have wandered across some border, but that they're escape pets. And yeah, crazy things can happen in the urban wildlands, and jaguarundis are one of them.
It's pretty unusual. You included trees in your bestiary. Why?
I did. Well, you know, I thought that, for one thing, trees are a magnificent presence, and many people feel a relationship to trees that is very profound. And I thought that it would be sort of a quirky and forward-thinking thing to do to include trees in a bestiary and sort of get people thinking differently about trees as presences. But when I look back to some of the medieval bestiaries, which is the form that, you know, my book is kind of an homage to this earlier medieval form, I found out that they often had trees in the bestiaries and that they treated as a kind of beast. So I was a little disappointed that it wasn't that original.
Oh.
But when I started talking to people that work with and study trees, I came to realize that everyone from, or many people, from poets to scientific researchers have felt that there's an energy in trees to which they can relate. And we all know that trees don't have central nervous systems. We know they don't have brains. So that relationship is certainly different than it is with other humans or animals. But people feel protect. I think that all of us can go back to some time in our life where we felt sheltered or protected or sustained by the presence of a tree.
Yes,
trees also have incredible health benefits. There are studies that show that if we have views of trees outside our hospital window, that we will recover more quickly from surgery than if there's no tree at all. And so I thought that they were worthy of consideration, you know, in the landscape. And I kind of wanted us to start thinking about them more expansively. So I had a lot of fun writing that chapter.
Well, Leanda Lynn Haupt, it's been a pleasure. She's an urban naturalist and an award-winning author. And her latest book is entitled The Urban Bestiary, or Bestiary, however you'd like to pronounce it, Encountering the Everyday Wild. She blogs at thetangledness.com. We want to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with maritime historian Nathaniel Philbrick. He ponders the question, why read Moby Dick? And more, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining celebrates Hispanic Heritage Month with Univision's celebrity chef, Ingrid Hoffman. And an all rock and roll calendar for October 9th. On this day in 1940, 73 years ago, the birth of Beatle John Lennon in Liverpool. The delivery was during a German air raid. He established his first band, The Quarrymen, in 1956 and first met Paul McCartney in 1957. And on this day in 1965, 48 years ago, The Beatles' Yesterday by Paul McCartney tops the pop charts and stays there for a month. It's the most covered song ever recorded. One more before we get all shook up. On this day in 1974, 39 years ago, Elvis and Priscilla Presley are granted a divorce. Priscilla gains custody of daughter Lisa Marie. So we leave with this from The King, quote, "The first time I appeared on stage, it scared me to death. I really didn't know what all the yelling was about. I didn't realize that my body was moving. It's a natural thing for me." Stay aboard. Next up, it's Here and Now from NPR News.